Today is Wednesday, October 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The only U.S. vice presidential debate takes place tonight. We have a look ahead.
Different than it was 4 years ago. You have an incumbent now running for re-election, so the choice is different. People are making a judgment about whether they want 4 more years of the current administration.
Plus,
Facebook began removing groups and pages linked to conspiracy theory movement QAnon on Tuesday, classifying them as dangerous.
And we say goodbye to two iconic musical legends. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump and Democratic candidate Joe Biden each said on Tuesday that they are looking forward to their second debate next week. But the issue of Trump's coronavirus infection has raised questions about the health protocols for the event. The Commission on Presidential Debates, the nonprofit group that is sponsoring the debates, has not yet commented on that matter. Several White House officials and other staff members are known to be infected with the virus. These include Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany and Presidential Advisor Hope Hicks. Trump also walked back his decision to hold off on a new coronavirus stimulus package until after the election. AP correspondent Mike Gracia takes things from here.
Hours after shutting down talks with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on additional COVID-19 relief until after the election, President Donald Trump backtracked. Trump took to Twitter Tuesday night and called for Congress to send him a standalone bill for stimulus checks. Trump tweeted, "I am ready to sign right now. Are you listening, Nancy?" The president also called on Congress to immediately approve $25 billion for airlines and $135 billion for the Paycheck Protection Program to help small businesses. Earlier Tuesday, Trump had tweeted that Pelosi was not negotiating in good faith, and he asked Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to focus on confirming Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. Mike Gracia, Washington.
The first and only vice presidential debate takes place Wednesday evening between Vice President Mike Pence and Senator Kamala Harris. Earlier today, I spoke with VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson to get a preview of tonight's contest in Salt Lake City, Utah. I began our conversation by asking Catherine about the precautions being put in place to protect each candidate from the coronavirus.
Well, we know that the two campaigns have been in negotiations with each other over the past few days about those precautions, both for the candidates themselves and for the debate moderator, USA Today editor Susan Page. At the moment, it looks like the candidates are going to be farther apart than in the presidential debate last week, 12 to 13 feet, as opposed to the 7 feet that separated President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden.
And for our international audience, that's about 4 meters between the two candidates, as opposed to the roughly 2 meters for the presidential debate.
They're also going to be getting plexiglass shields that will keep each of the candidates and the debate moderator behind a shield that, you know, we've actually become very used to seeing in some stores and some people wearing here in the United States. So in a sense, they're kind of going along with what we've gotten used to during the pandemic here in the United States.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. So, what does each candidate need to do during the debate to make the case that their ticket is the best one for the nation? And what lines of questioning provide the most vulnerability against them? For that, I spoke with Villanova University political science professor Matthew Kerbel.
Vice presidential debates historically do not move the needle very much. Having said that, your question is, what do these two candidates need to do tonight in order to be successful? So when you have an incumbent, it's different than it was 4 years ago. You have an incumbent now running for re-election, so the choice is different. People are making a judgment about whether they want 4 more years of the current administration. And so Mike Pence needs to speak on behalf of the administration. He's going to be in a position where he has to defend the administration's record. And given the events of the past week, it's hard to imagine that COVID isn't going to hang over everything. And of course, he was in charge of the COVID task force for the administration. So I would expect that Senator Harris is going to press him on that. In terms of what the challenger needs to do, typically in a vice presidential debate, even though it's the two vice presidential candidates on stage, the challenging candidate is really looking to make a case against the president. So I would expect Senator Harris to go after Vice President Pence in a way that really goes after the president's record, right? So she is basically a surrogate for Joe Biden, making the case against Donald Trump in a debate with Mike Pence.
You mentioned that Vice President Pence was in charge of the White House coronavirus task force, and that certainly could be one of the areas where he is vulnerable during the debate. But what do you see as the vulnerabilities on both sides? Where are they most vulnerable to lines of attack, during this debate?
Well, you know, I would suspect that the vice president is going to go after Senator Harris's record. It would surprise me if he doesn't try to paint her as being off to the left, because we've seen that from the Trump campaign before, that the president has made the allegation that no matter what you may think of Joe Biden, he's basically a captive of what he might characterize as the far left. And I think there may be an attempt to try to characterize Senator Harris in those terms. Senator Harris is going to go after the president's record. And certainly there is the president's record on COVID, using the vice president's position as the head of the COVID task force, I think is as an entree to that argument.
As the debate continues throughout the evening, what are you going to be keeping your eye out for this evening?
Well, you know, the debates are largely performance. You know, I'm looking to see what the atmospherics are. What is communicated? You know, how does the fact that the two candidates are going to be sitting separated by plexiglass at desks, what is the tone of the debate? And then the question, of course, is, are there any memorable lines?
Matthew Kerbel is a political science professor at Villanova University in Pennsylvania. The White House National Security Advisor says there is evidence that foreign governments are tampering with the U.S. presidential election. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien says the United States will not tolerate any election interference from foreign countries, telling his Russian counterpart to stay out of the November election. O'Brien, at a security summit in Salt Lake City, says the Russians told him they weren't planning to interfere, but there's already evidence that they have. He says there are signs China, Iran, and some other countries that he wouldn't name are also meddling in U.S. politics. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Facebook on Tuesday classified the QAnon conspiracy theory movement as dangerous and began removing Facebook groups and pages, as well as Instagram accounts that hold themselves out as its representatives. Reuters' Gloria So has more.
QAnon is a conspiracy theory that believes U.S. President Donald Trump is secretly fighting a group of child sex predators that includes prominent Democrats, Hollywood elites, and deep state allies. Researchers say recent QAnon posts have spread false information about voting and about COVID-19, even claiming that Trump faked his COVID-19 diagnosis in order to orchestrate secret arrests. In a company blog post, Facebook announced they would now treat QAnon like other militarized bodies, seeking out and deleting groups and pages instead of relying on user reports across both Facebook and Instagram. Facebook's latest step marks a major escalation from an earlier policy in August that banned just a third of QAnon groups for promoting violence while allowing most to stay, albeit with their content appearing less often in news feeds. But since the August restrictions, some QAnon groups have added members. Others have used coded language to evade detection, some referring to the word Q instead of the letter Q. Meanwhile, researchers say QAnon adherents have also integrated themselves in other groups, such as those concerned with child safety and those critical of restrictions on gatherings due to the coronavirus. Classed as a potential source of domestic terrorism by the FBI, QAnon is driven by an anonymous internet poster nicknamed Q, who claims to be a Trump administration insider. And the fictitious satanic rituals that the group cites echo long-standing legends used to anger people for political reasons, often against minorities. However, Trump has praised the group as patriotic, and more than a dozen Republican congressional candidates have promoted it.
Gloria So reports for Reuters News. Still to come.
That means that if we want it to be really, really sensitive and pick up the smallest potential exposures, we can set the app so that it's going to notify somebody with the smallest exposures.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. Scientists have proposed that early Mars was warm with vast amounts of liquid water flowing across its surface. A trio of scientists released a new study in the journal Nature Geoscience that disputes this popular theory. Instead, they propose the red planet was covered with ice sheets and that its valleys, thought to have been formed from free-flowing liquid water, were carved by water melting beneath them. The authors examined more than 10,000 valleys on Mars to determine processes used to shape them. Noticing the similarities of the Martian valleys with channels of subglacial meltwater on islands of the Canadian Arctic archipelago, they performed a comparative analysis. The researchers suggest their theory explains how valleys could have formed on a planet further from a weaker sun than Earth 3.8 billion years ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. With roughly 36 million cases of COVID-19 confirmed around the world and just over 27,000 cases in Australia, beachgoers were warned to stay away from Sydney's most famous arc of sand. COVID-19 restrictions have forced beaches to close near Australia's biggest city as scorching spring temperatures sent thousands of people to the coast. Phil Mercer reports.
Heading to the coast is a quintessential Australian pastime. But warmer weather in the southern hemisphere is testing the nation's plans to keep the coronavirus at bay. Visitor numbers are now limited, and two beaches south of Sydney were closed to avoid overcrowding. Swimmers also were told to avoid Bondi and Coogee, as thousands of people flocked to two of Sydney's most popular arcs of sand. COVID-19 marshals and the police have been on patrol to ensure people stayed a towel length apart. The authorities have said the public's response has been encouraging, but beachgoers have had mixed opinions about the safety measures.
I think it's pretty good. I think everyone's social distancing, so I think it's fine.
I'm absolutely outraged, to be honest. This is ridiculous. It's too many people. Yes, I am here as well, and I'm going to go have a swim, but, you know, we shouldn't be, should we?
Australia has recorded about 27,000 COVID-19 cases since the pandemic began, and 900 people have died. Most states and territories have managed to contain the coronavirus. Queensland has reported no new infections in the past day. Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk says the community is heeding hygiene and distancing advice.
Once again, I just want to congratulate Queenslanders for the great work that they have done. The results that we have had because of our health response has been because Queenslanders have listened. We have seen that time and time again, whether it's dealing with cyclones and natural disasters, whether it's dealing with bushfires. Queenslanders come together. It's an incredible story.
Lockdown measures, however, still apply in the city of Melbourne. Residents can only leave home for essential activities. Health officials there have said that restrictions will ease later this month if infection rates continue to fall. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Iran's health ministry registered a record high 239 new coronavirus deaths in the past 24 hours, taking the total to 27,658. It also added just over 4,000 new cases. Iran is the worst hit country in the Middle East. At the University of Arizona, students and staff are using an app that lets them know if they've been exposed to someone who has tested positive for the coronavirus. Michelle Quinn reports on how the app gives health authorities the ability to fine-tune advice to people who have been exposed.
At the University of Arizona, students are encouraged to download COVID Watch, an app developed on campus that lets them know if they've been exposed to someone who's tested positive for the coronavirus. The app also helps determine the person's risk of getting infected based on that exposure, providing health officials with important information to help tailor their advice in each case. Joyce Schroeder, a molecular and cellular biology professor, is the campus lead working on the app.
The campus itself has the ability now to set the exposure notification levels. And what does that mean? That means that if we want it to be really, really sensitive and pick up the smallest potential exposures, we can set the app so that it's going to notify somebody with the smallest exposures. We can go all the way in the other direction and set it so that it's only notifying people if they're absolutely, no question, heavily exposed to somebody.
Around the country, officials are turning to apps like these to help in the fight against COVID. They are using the technology to figure out when to notify people who've been exposed and what to tell them to do next, says Jeffrey Kahn, director of Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics.
There's a little bit of laboratory of the states happening, so Arizona may do something, Virginia may do something else, and we will learn. You know, maybe we won't learn everything we need to for this pandemic, but everything we learn in this pandemic will be useful for the next pandemic.
The standard health recommendation now is if you're exposed to the virus, you stay home for 14 days. But Samir Halai, co-founder of COVID Watch, says technology like his app gives health officials the ability to personalize what they tell people to do.
We individualize the quarantine recommendation based on your specific exposure history. What we're also now adding is personalization, where we can look at your specific risk profile, your age, pre-existing conditions, and things like that. Then those are some things we can use to personalize recommendations even further. We need to be more nuanced about what we ask people to do.
The app can work based on a community's specific needs, Halai said. A city with few cases may want to notify and lock down everyone who's been exposed. A city with a major outbreak might not be able to do that and would set the app to notify people most at risk. But the first step, getting people to download the app.
I had, like, I guess, like, privacy questions about it. Like, I wasn't sure how much information am I, like, giving my name? Am I knowing exact people who, you know, oh, that person has had contact, like, stay away from them. I didn't know if, like, that was the energy behind it.
I feel like read up on it a little bit, and honestly, I feel pretty good about it. I don't know. I know there's, like, they've done a lot of stuff to avoid privacy issues, so I think it sounds pretty legit.
University officials are in a race against the virus, hoping the app will help them to keep people safe and allow the campus to stay open. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
VOA has expanded coverage of the pandemic on our website. South Korean lawmakers and officials raised concerns on Wednesday about the safety of the teenage daughter of a former senior North Korean diplomat in Italy after news reports that he had settled in South Korea while she was sent back to the North. South Korean lawmakers say a senior North Korean diplomat who vanished in Italy in 2018 lives in South Korea under government protection. Jo Sung-gil had been acting ambassador to Italy, and if confirmed, he would be the highest-ranking defector to the South since a former senior ruling party official arrived in 1997. South Korea's spy agency earlier had told lawmakers that Jo had left his residence in Rome with his wife and was at an unspecified location. Officials in Kyrgyzstan have nullified the results of a weekend parliamentary election after mass protests erupted in the capital of Bishkek and other cities, with opposition supporters seizing government buildings and demanding a new vote. Members of several opposition parties announced plans to oust President Sooronbay Jeenbekov and form a new government. Two presidents have been overthrown in Kyrgyzstan in the past 15 years. Kyrgyzstan borders China and hosts both a Russian military airbase and a large Canadian-owned gold mining operation. Russian President Vladimir Putin said Wednesday Moscow was in touch with all the sides in the conflict and hoped that the diplomatic process would be restored soon. Belarus opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is in Berlin for meetings with top German officials. She's meeting on Wednesday with Norbert Röttgen, a top lawmaker in Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservative Party. The opposition leader of the ex-Soviet Republic is the main opponent of Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko. Opposition figures and some poll workers say the country's August election results were fraudulent. Tikhanovskaya has been trying to lobby support across the political spectrum in Germany for the Belarus opposition movement. The Nobel Prize Committee has announced this year's prize in chemistry.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has today decided to award the 2020 Nobel Prize in Chemistry jointly to Emmanuelle Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna for the development of a method for genome editing.
Charpentier, who is French, and Doudna, an American, became the sixth and seventh women to win the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, joining the likes of Marie Curie, who won in 1911, and more recently, Francis Arnold in 2018. The pair developed a method of genome editing likened to molecular scissors that offer the promise of one day curing genetic diseases. Singer-songwriter Johnny Nash has died. AP Entertainment correspondent Oscar Wells Gabriel looks back at his life and career. I can see
clearly now. You might think of Johnny Nash as a one-hit wonder, but not only did he have other hit songs, he also ran a record company, was an American-born reggae singer, and helped launch the career of a friend of his, a guy named Bob Marley. Yeah, Johnny Nash was a lot more than the guy who made I Can See Clearly Now a smash hit in 1972. As a teenager, his voice was compared to that of Johnny Mathis. And although I Can See Clearly Now is usually considered a source of inspiration, the meaning apparently was more practical. It is said that he wrote it while recovering from cataract surgery. Johnny Nash was 80 when he died of natural causes. I'm Oscar Wells Gabriel.
In addition, guitar virtuoso Eddie Van Halen died on Tuesday after battling cancer. Eddie Van Halen supplied the unmistakable grinding solo in Michael Jackson's hit Beat It and had hits with Jump and Panama, just to name two. With his distinct solos, Van Halen fueled the ultimate California party band and helped knock disco off the charts starting in the late 1970s with his band's self-titled debut album. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Religious freedom is a fundamental right enshrined in the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Peter Berkowitz, the director of policy planning at the State Department, said there is a correlation between countries that protect religious freedom and those that respect other basic rights.
We know as an empirical matter this high correlation between countries that protect religious liberty and countries that protect all the other freedoms that the United States has traditionally cared about. And this, of course, makes sense. If you're protecting the liberty to have a difference of opinion about one of the matters that human beings have fought over most, difference of opinions about God.
There are authoritarian countries, including China, Iran, and Russia, that claim because the United States does not perfectly uphold human rights at home, it has no standing to promote such rights abroad. But Director Berkowitz calls this suggestion outrageous.
There is a fundamental difference between liberal democracies, such as the United States, which are grounded in an affirmation of human rights, and countries like China, Iran, Russia, which repudiate the very idea of human rights. Of course the United States falls short. Just as no individual human being is perfectly virtuous, no country on the planet perfectly honors the imperatives of human rights. The United States formally and in practice remains committed to vindicating human rights. Of course, I don't mean to deny that there are courageous dissenters in Russia, China, and Iran. We know that there are. But a political society as a whole is not permitted to have such conversations.
The United States Declaration of Independence and the UN Declaration of Human Rights, said Director Berkowitz, set forth a universal standard for judging all forms of government, and that standard is what all government should aspire to. He also expressed his hope that people come to an appreciation that liberal democracy is the form of government best suited to vindicating human rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.